Okay, just to let everybody know, but right, just where Dr. Mark started, the plan is this week and next week, we're going to finish off the series. And then in 2 weeks, we're going to start a new series. And they're being posted one by one. But, within a day or two, we'll send out an email of all our sort of fall scheduling. So just keep an eye out for that. And nice to see you. Welcome everybody back. Hope everybody's doing well. We should. Okay, Dr. Mark, Vakasha.
Okay, good. Just because we only have two more classes and I have important things to do about the Chazon Ish, I'll just respond quickly to two things and then get right into it because I've got some really interesting stuff today and, of course, tomorrow as well. Okay, you might recall, those who've been with me a while, I've made the point, I've even shown you pictures from ads from Yeshiva University in which they refuse to use the title for female Torah scholars, any title at all, it's just misses. In fact, I've even shown you that the title Rabbanit, which is acceptable in Israel, when a Rabbanit comes to YU, they will put up like their ads, like in the Jewish link, for those of you who know what it is. The one from Israel is given the title Rabbanit, and the others are given they don't have any title. And we spoke about that. So one of you wrote to me that this makes perfect, and I said how foolish this is. It doesn't make any sense at all. One of you wrote to me and said, however, the reason for this is as follows, in 2015, the Rabbinical Council of America, here it is, came out with a policy concerning women rabbis. Everyone knows about the OU statement. We've spoken about it a lot, but the RCA also has a statement. And in the RCA statement, the resolution says that no RCA members may ordain women into the Orthodox rabbinate, regardless of the title used. Two, hire or ratify the hiring of a woman into a rabbinic position in an Orthodox institution. And three, and this is what the person points out, allow a title implying rabbinic ordination to be used by a teacher of Limud HaKodesh in an Orthodox institution. So therefore, this person who wrote to me says that's why they can't use Rabbanit, because the RCA says you can't. But you miss the point. Rabbanit does not mean rabbinic ordination. 99.9% of the women teaching Torah in Israel who are called Rabbanit do not have rabbinic ordination. Who gives rabbinic ordination? Harel and Lindenbaum? And one other place in Israel, they're just called Rabbanit as a term showing their Torah scholarship, how much they know. A woman who is considered a Torah scholar is given, they don't actually have ordination. Now, what is ordination? In other words, they never sat for an exam and passed an exam like that, but through their teaching, the title rabbi, just like Rabbanit, just like many rabbis. People don't realize this. A lot of rebbes teaching at yeshivas, unless they went to YU, don't have smicha per se. They're called rabbi because they're Torah teachers. That's what the term is. The Rambam never had smicha, you know, and Rav Sadia Gaon, et cetera, et cetera. So my comment is still valid because these women don't have any, quote, rabbinic ordination. They're just called Rabbanit because they're, you want to recognize Torah scholarship. So I find it strange. I still find it strange that in America, at these so-called centrist institutions, they have such a hard time calling their people Rabbanit. That was my point. Okay, so that's clear. And two, as many of you sent me stuff about the so-called Kuzari proof. In fact, just on 2 days ago in Boca Grove Synagogue, where among the people who are there is David Shapiro, the former ambassador, and Ben Shapiro, no relation to me, but he's there as well in that show. But that's not the people I was talking to. Max, who listens to us, and his son, who's 15, who listens to all of them. And so I was speaking about the Kuzari proof, and I don't want to get into it again. I just want to read you something in the Ramban. Okay, I'll read it from the English Chavels, and this is relevant for reasons, obvious reasons. It's in the Ramban's commentary on Bamidbar, chapter 15, Pasuk 22. And let me just, in speaking about, sinning and Beshogeg and interesting Ramban, he says as follows. He speaks about, in the days of the wicked kings of Israel, such as Yerovah, most of the people, I think he means most of the people in Yes, I met David Friedman. Not to, thank you, Mel. Not David Shapiro. David Shapiro is my brother. That's why I said it. Okay, it says most of the people. I mean, most of the people in Israel, the Northern Kingdom, forgot the Torah. But and listen to this. And we also see that most of the people he's saying forgot the Torah, as we see in the book of Ezra, concerning the people of the Second Temple. And Chavel, in his explanation, explains that the Ramban is referring, he says, to the ordinary people, not the this intelligent ones. But he says that although that's not what the Pasuk says, what he says. And what is he referred to? He's referring to the fact that the people, as we mentioned, they came back from captivity. They didn't know about Sukkos. What the Ramban is saying is that most of the people had no Masorah. They didn't have any memory or a tradition of the giving of the Torah. What did they do? They listened to Ezra. And, or the, oops, hold on. My paper book fell. Hold on. So we see the Ramban saying that based on Ezra, we see that there wasn't this continuing tradition. So it's not like someone could say, well, I heard this from my father, or heard it from his father, etc. The Ramban's telling you, as we saw in Ezra, that most people, I mean, it's even more than most if you take them shot. Most, I mean, Chavel tries to say it's only the masses, but we see at least the masses didn't have a Masorah anymore. So they couldn't say that my father told me this because his grandfather, that's where Sadia Gaon cites as the proof. No, they trusted Ezra, that when Ezra told them this is what happened, that they believed Ezra. So, by the way, the Kuzari himself, Yehuda Levi, mentions this in book three, number section 54, that the masses had, he quotes in Nehemiah, that they had lost knowledge of the Torah. And he himself says, however, that it's the masses were not, but the erudite, they knew it. Okay, but let's get back now to, let me put this away, hold on, get back to where we are. And as Rabbi Kalman says, we have two more classes. You know, I said last time about, actually, I want to show you this something. I mentioned Netanyahu's grandfather, not grandfather, father-in-law. And so I want to show you here. Let me pull it up on the screen. Shmuel Ben Artzi, he's a Nevardiker. He died about 14 years ago. He's a Nevardiker. You can read the Hebrew. He wrote two books on Nevardic. Two books of basically giving stories. If you read the article here, you'll see that he came in 1933, the Talmidim of Beis Yosef, who established the Yeshivas Beis Yosef, the Vardik in Bnei Brak. During his time in Israel, he became a chalutz, and he, it says here, because he was anger at the, you know, that the rabbis, about the, let's see, on the Rav, I don't know which Rav, who prevented people, told people not to make Aliyah and died in the Holocaust. Hifsik lishmor Torah mitzvot. He became irreligious. And he was irreligious for decades. At the end of his life, he returned to religion. But he's one of the early Nevardikers in Israel, Shmuel Ben Artzi. And if you read, you look here, he has, he wrote in 67, a book of stories about Nevardik, and in 2007 as well, another one. So his son is Chagai Ben Artzi, who wrote, first of all, wrote a book on Rav Kook, and he also wrote a Haggadah, like a 1967, like Yom Yerushalayim Haggadah, that what tells the story, not Haggadah, Megillah, tells it like a story of the liberation of Jerusalem. He also has been a big attacker of his brother-in-law, Benjamin Netanyahu, for not being right-wing enough. So that's the person I mentioned. Okay. When you think about the Chazon Ish and his attitudes towards Musar, and we'll call the Musar dispute, the major source, as I mentioned, is this book by Benny Brown, who hasn't spoken for Torah in Motion. He speaks English fine. The Chazon Ish He has a whole chapter there, chapter two. Much of it is devoted to the dispute of the Chazanish with the Musar teachers. I mean, acknowledges, as we saw, that in certain ways they're close, but in other ways they're far, and we'll give some examples. Now, just since I mentioned women Torah scholars, I guess she would be called a Rabbanit. Chana Kahat has this book called From When Torah, When the Torah Turned into Talmud Torah. Changes in the idea of the concept of Talmud Torah. And it's a thick, thick book, as you can see. It's 744 pages, which would be almost, I guess, 1,000 pages in English. She has a chapter on Limud HaTorah and Rav Kook in Hasidut Poland, in the Netziv, in the Chazon Ish. She, by the way, is the daughter of Rav Shlomo Fischer, one of the most fascinating Gedolim of our time. And maybe because Rav Shlomo Fischer had a daughter who's so brilliant that he ruled Halacha Maisa, that a woman could say, could do, could participate in the Sheva Brachos. When his daughter, granddaughter, Hanukkah's daughter, was married, she asked her, Rav Shlomo Fischer, Rosh Yeshiva Vitri, could they have women do Sheva Brachos? Now, I don't know what the RCA or the OU say about that. They probably will say no, but the Gaon Rav Shlomo Fischer said yes, that women can do, and they did do Sheva Brachos. Now, when you think about this is what is shown by Benny Brown. When you think about the criticisms of the Chazon Ish, it's primarily Navardic, and that's when it's going to be portrayed as well in Chaim Grada. But we'll also see today there's also a strong criticism of one aspect of Slobodka Musar, and we won't get into this class, but the next class, the last one, the great dispute over how to judge stories in Tanakh. We will see that that's also a dispute between the more mainstream Musar. Now, where do we see the criticism of the Chazon Ish of Musar? Well, it's in his little book, which I would call a Musar text itself, called Umunah Bitachon, which is a Musar text and presents the Chazon Ish's ideas. Now, virtually all of the criticism there is made without specific mention of Musar, of the Musar movement. But it's clear who he's referring to in most of the places. Now, regarding this book, I actually made a mistake last class when I said that, I said that the three chapters of the book, which contain sharp criticism of certain manifestations, the Muslim were not included. It's actually two chapters. Although when the two chapters were omitted, were reprinted only in 1997. Before that, they were just handed out. People had copies of them, but it never been published. He turned them for some reason to three chapters. And that's why I made a mistake. I looked more carefully. Not only did I make a mistake last week, I made a mistake in my book, Changing the Immutable, by saying that only two chapters were included in this volume. The translation, Faith and Trust. Actually, all the chapters are there. It's just the order is a bit reversed. And instead of being three chapters, two chapters. But in this book by Yaakov, the translation by Yaakov Goldstein, he doesn't translate the passages against Musar. He doesn't translate them. He translates the entire book. But I guess he felt that since these were taken out, now they're being put back in, at least in Israel, you can see them. He doesn't want to be responsible for letting us know what the Chazon Ish. He just wants to present what's available now in Israel, but he doesn't want to translate it. As I mentioned, there is no evidence that the Chazon Ish had anything to do with this. This came out posthumously. And we have no reason to assume that the Chazon Ish was opposed to it being published completely. I mean, maybe it wasn't. Who knows? But we have no knowledge, at least to my knowledge, we have no reason to think so. It's the same thing with his critique of the Chazon Ish, which has become so important. In fact, you have Svarim, which focus on the criticism of the Chazon Ish. And yet the claim has been made that this never should have been published, that he never wanted his criticism of the Brisker Method to be published. So it's hard to say that if a Chazon Ish writes something, especially in a Torah matter, we're not dealing with a personal attack or anything, that he won't want it to be published. But that claim has been made. Now, the chapters that are missing, if you have the Emunah Bitachon, are 28 and 29. I can send them to anyone in the original. Let me just give you an example of the things which he includes, which he doesn't translate, and you get a sense as to why they didn't want to include it. And so, for instance, chapter 29 of the original Emunah Bitachon, where he quotes, he's quoting Reb Chaim of Volozhin, he's speaking about people who degrade Torah scholars. As we saw already, that this was a problem among the followers of Musar, that sometimes they went overboard, and those Gedolim who didn't support Musar, they did not treat them with the respect because they thought that they were opponents of Musar and they don't deserve respect. And sometimes they went overboard. I mean, a real Musar personality would treat the opponents of Musar properly, even if they are not being correct in the way they treat the Musar rites. So he says that Hashem Yisrach Lahem, Ki Kavatzam L'Shamayim, Avol Lozo Aderech. But this, you know, that he's saying that the sharp criticism, your Pitzur Chaim of Volozhin, of these people who don't treat the Gedolim properly, you know, all the Gedolim we spoke about who opposed Musar, he says their intentions are for heaven, but their actions are not. And then he says that the Reb Chaim of Volozhin is the teacher of the teachers of Rav Yisrael Salanter. And therefore, these people, of course, should know better because Rav Yisrael Salanter would agree with everything Reb Chaim of Volozhin says. He says Rav Yisrael Salanter does not believe, this is, he quotes him specifically, that Sifrei Yira Musar B'liyo Eso Chacham B'Hacha Gemara Perish Tosfos. He says Rav Yisrael Salanter would be the first one to say that you can't be a Musar leader and you can't just look at Sifrei Musar and Yira, that's Musar books, without being a great Talmud Chacham in traditional Talmud study. That was another criticism, which and the Chazon Ish is acknowledging that some followers of Musar, they focus too much on Musar and they forget about the Gemara. And Rav Yisrael Salanter would be the first one to say this is not correct. And then he goes on, and he repeats the same thing, that those people who degrade great Torah scholars, the Gemara says that you have a sass of an apikoros if you don't treat Torah scholars properly. He says even those Torah scholars who would study Torah not l'shema, you know, that you still have to respect them for their great Torah knowledge. Obviously, all the more so everyone else. And then he says, Uval HaMusar. So here he specifically says, those Musarites, Shemisnase Belibo Neged Talmud Chacham, who think that they're greater than the Talmud Chacham, Umashpilo So Belibo. And inside, they degrade these Talmud Chacham, even if they don't publicly say it, but they don't think positively about them because they don't believe in Musar. And he says, all the more so when they do it publicly, Shehu Bicham Mavaza Talmud Chacham Shadino Kapikoris. So the Chazon Ish says that those Musarites, even if they don't publicly say it, but they think negative about these Gedolim who themselves are not Musar supporters, they have the status of an apikoris. The Ein Talmud Chacham Ela HaChacham B'Halacha, the Gimel Pei Tet, the Gemara Perish Tosfos. And you can't be a real Talmud Chacham unless you have, you know, Gemara learning. And then he says, Manora Huamara, how awesome is this site? I mean, he means in a negative way that people who make act as if they're Talmid Chachamim and have rabbinic positions, and they preach about Musar and Chassidus Kol Hayom. So when he says Musar and Chassidus, I don't think he means Chassidus as in Chassidim. I think he's talking about Musar here. Heim Heima Mikat Mevazei Talmid Chacham. So he says, I mean, this is his strongest criticism. He's saying that you have certain rabbis in the Musar world, and this can only refer to, I believe, the Navardikers, that they are degrading Talmud Chachamim, Talmid Chachamim. He calls them a kat. And he says, it's true that they are shogegim, the Kavanas HaMritzuya, and they have good intentions, but they're destroying Torah with what they do. So we see why this was never released. Earlier in chapter 28, he's speaking about Musar people who want to, they want to discuss, you know, they want to focus on, let's say, the non-halachic exceptions of the Torah, the Agadah. And they teach this, they lecture on it. But he says they don't know, they haven't learned Tanakh, and they don't understand Agadah, you know, and they don't know what the Gemara says about it. They just pick up a passage and they start preaching about it. So, well, we do see strong criticism there. Now, Benny Brown in his book wonders why, if they were going to censor, there's other passages they could have censored also, and it's not clear why they didn't. So, for example, if you look in, this is in book or section 3, chapter 18, he also speaks strongly. He doesn't mention Musar by name. Now, what I saw before, chapter 29, he mentions Musarites by name. But here he's clearly speaking to Musar. He's talking about the Musarites. He's talking about time wasted on fabricated ideas, on notions, on innovations that have nothing to do with the Moshe Rabbeinu who heard from Sinai. Even though the topic is fear of heaven and perfection of one's character traits, he says that this kind of study is not the goal of man, is if you don't accompany it with practical knowledge of the laws of Torah. So he says that they think that they're doing the ways of the Gemara, the sages of the Gemara, but by putting halacha secondary, but that's mistaken. So that's a strong criticism as well. Brown portrays the criticism between the Chazonish and the Musarites as really a continuation of the earlier dispute between in Lithuania between, I guess you can call it, Torah and Yira. So Brown, on, for those of you who have the book, you can check it out on page 132 and 133. It's basically the idea to, you know, what's going to create the proper personality? Is it just enough to study Torah, or do you need to also study Yira before there was a Musar movement? And you had the discussion of that as well. So for and it predates it goes back to Rishon Salanter, and even you sign texts that really speak to this matter even before him. But listen to this from Rishon Salanter that Brown quotes. This could never have been said by the Chazon Ish. He says that mitzvahs Talmud Torah levad. When I say from Rishon Salanter, Rishon Salanter quoted from Rav Yitzchak Blazer. So I guess the Chazon Ish could say that this is the distortion of Yitzchak Blazer. He says the mitzvah of learning Torah. He kashar kol mitzvos. It's like all their mitzvos. The ein la yachos klali yiras Hashem. That is the study. Let's say you're studying Hilchos Shabbos or Masechas Baba Kama. It has nothing to do with yira. Kamosh ein yichos yachos lashar mitzvos. Kamosh shofar v'sukav luav liyiras Hashem. It's just like if I shake a luav, that's not obviously I gotta shake a luav. It's a mitzvah, but that has nothing to do with yira. That's not going to turn me. That's not going to create the Torah personality that we need. Zelachud is Zelachud. You have to shake the luluf and you have to do yira. And Rav Shlomo Salanter is quoted as saying that the mitzvah of limud Torah is just like shaking luluf and a shofar. That is, it's just a mitzvah and has nothing to do with yira. Now, what for the Chazon Ish, by definition, and the others, if you study Torah properly, that will bring yira on its own. So Rav Shlomo Salanter rejects this entirely. And now that's the dispute, of course, we know. In fact, the Chazon Ish himself cites Rav Yisrael Salanter as agreeing with him. He even says that he cites Rav Yisrael Salanter as we already saw this, that you need, contrary to what I just quoted you, he cites him as how it was vital to have Torah study for itself. Now, we've seen already discussions of citing of Rishon Salanter. You know, the first generation of the opponents of Musar also cited Rishon Salanter in opposition to what Musar became. In fact, I'll give you another example. If you look in the Tshuvas Sefer of Rabbi Hinken, Yehuda Ritzel Hinken, in volume 2, page 209, he has in the back there statements from his grandfather, the great Rav Yosef Eliyahu Hinken. This is by someone in his last years who was a Harusa, Yeshiva Bacher, who was a Harusa with Rav Hinken, recorded these things. And he says that he heard from Rav Hinken that he does not agree with the approach of the altar of Sobotka, even though he admired the altar himself. He says that the Shita of Musar of the Saba, that is the altar of Sabatka, is not the Shita of Musar of Rabbi Yisrael Salant. He says, Rav Henkin says, to learn Musar a half hour a day is good. And we did this in Slutsk, but more than that is not good. Now, I mean, they didn't learn more than a half hour a day in Slobodka, most of the people. But as we know, Musar became like a central feature. And that was a guiding light for everyone. And so he's saying that that's not what it's about. For Rishon Salanter, yes, you have to do Musar, but it's not like up there with Talmud study in Slobodka. Musar was on the same rung as Talmud study. Yes, you put more time into Talmud study, but Musar was on the same rung, and we saw it didn't detract from their learning. Because Rav Henkin is saying that, you know, the original way of Rishon Salanter, obviously you have to have the order, and you can't exaggerate Musar. This page, by the way, is where some of the famous things of Rav Henkin are quoted on. So, for instance, that Rav Henkin's insistence that the Aruch HaShulchan trumps the Mishnah Berurah. Rav Moshe Feinstein held the same thing. There's been a complete turnaround in our day that the Mishnah Berurah is considered the Poseg Acharon of the yeshiva world. But Rav Moshe and Rav Henkin said just the opposite. Also on this page, he says something interesting. That the Chachmei Chaim was the Tzadik Hador, but the Tzadik Hador can't be the Posek Hador because he's going to be too machmir. That's what he says. And then he speaks about the Chazon Ish too. He says that this is something they were censored if Art Scroll ever printed this. That although he admired the Chazon Ish a lot, he said that the Chazon Ish had a problem because he only studied by himself. He didn't have any chavrusas. He didn't consult with the other Gedolim. He came up with his ideas himself without, and then that led him to make certain mistakes in Rabbi Epstein's book. He says Makor Baruch. He quotes the Netziv as saying this about the Rambam, I believe. Yeah, that he on his own. Yes, unlike the Rashba. And people say, well, how could, is that really true? Could he have said it? Well, we see here that Rav Henkin said that. And finally, he quotes it here as saying that that in general, he agreed with the Hashkafa of Rav Kook. So the student asked him, what do you mean you agree with the Hashkafa of Rav Kook? It's well known Rav Henkin opposed, he was an anti-Zionist. He opposed the creation of the state. And he said that Rav Kook also wouldn't have agreed to create a state if it led to spilling of blood. Rav Henkin opposed creating the state because he thought it would lead to great destruction, killing of many Israelis. And once the state was created, he became its biggest supporter. And he says Rav Kook would not have supported a state if it would lead to such death. Whether he would or wouldn't, I don't know, but that's what he says. Okay, returning to the Chazon Ish. Brown, as I said, he focuses on Navarda, and he gives examples, Brown, what the Chazon Ish would have had a problem with Navardic. So, for instance, he mentions this idea of Hefkerus in Navardic, that basically you weren't concerned with money at all. And, you know, whatever you had, other people can have. But that's not halacha. Halacha says you know, there's a limit to how much money you can give. This idea of hefkerus, that you can give all your money away to tzedakah, like a nevarda, or you give it all away. But the halacha says you can't do that. You only give one-fifth of it away. And halacha for the Chazon Ish, you know, halacha tells you how to make a parnasa, what you have to do. So this idea of nevardic, and we'll see later his other criticisms of nevardic, about Emuna. So that's, he says he'd have a problem with it. And I mean, the Brown says, and he quotes from a source, which I don't have access to. I mean, he quotes from Grada, but I don't have the exact page numbers because he's quoting in the Hebrew, where that the Navardic people would be prepared to defend one who's the weaker one. Because, you're in a din Torah, so someone who's poor. However, but if in halacha, you can't just go with the Chazal say this, you can't just go with the weaker, you have to go with who's ever right. Look, if you cause $1,000 damage to Elon Musk and he takes you to Baystin, the Baystin can't say $1,000. Musk makes that in half a second, the interest on his investments. You have to decide halacha properly, not be Robin Hood. And he says that the Navarrekar's idea was differently, that they would ignore the halacha on this matter. Did they? Maybe they did. I don't know. It could be that Grada is exaggerating. But so already we see that there's going to be problems between the Chazon Ish and Nevardic. And indeed, the Chazon Ish's strongest criticism against Nevardic. Now, we've discussed the Chazon Ish's relationship in the past many times with the writer Chaim Grada. I don't need to go through it again. I'll just say that Chaim Grada, who starts out as his Talmud, his student, and also a student in Nevardic, then leaves the Torah world, but still has this great love for the Chazon Ish. Only after the Chazon Ish's death could he come to Eretz Yisrael, where he writes that poem. I mean, he couldn't face the Chazon Ish being irreligious, becoming a an irreligious writer. Now, he writes a book, which in Yiddish is called Tzemach. It's two volumes. Now, in English, we call it the Yeshiva. Highly recommend it. And in Hebrew, one volume is called, the second volume is called Tzemach, and that's the Musar figure, the Nevardiker. And volume one is called Milchemes HaYetzer. That is the fight, the war over the evil inclination. Now, Tzemach represents, does he represent the Nevardic or Rosh Yeshiva, or he's a composite of different Nevardic figures? It's unclear. The star, the main character, Haeckel, that's Chaim Grada, and Rav Avraham Yeshaya of Kosov is the Chazon Ish. Avraham Yeshaya is Karelitz. He's called the Machaza Avraham, but in his real life, of course, he wrote the Chazon Ish, Machaza Chazon, and that is really where you find the best descriptions of the Chazon Ish. It isn't just me saying it, or Professor Tursky saying it. The Haredi world acknowledges, so much so that this volume came out. A Chaz Avraham, Mechayim Aran HaChazon Ish. What is this? This is, and I can send this to anyone. This is, it's only 116 pages as opposed to like the 400 pages of the original. This is a censored volume. It's Nilkat mitocha sefer Tzemach Atlas me'eid ha-sofer v'ha-meshorer Chaim Grada. What they've done is they've removed everything that a Haredi would have a problem reading, what they think is heretical or risque, and what you're and they have an introduction here. Huh? He says that because Chaim Grada was not unfortunately a Shomer Torah mitzvos, and you can't take everything per se that he says accurately, but. He says, since you get a God benefit from this, from his description of the Chazon Ish, therefore we decided, with great effort, let's tzanzer heitev as a sefer, that we've censored the book a great deal in order to, so now yeshiva students can pick his book up and they can learn about the person who was the only record we have of someone from that time in the Chazon Ish's life, before he comes to Eretz Yisrael, before he was so famous. Let me read you the great, look, there's the whole book is about descriptions with the Chazon Ish and then descriptions of the Nevardiker, but there's one scene there where the Chazon Ish has a great dispute with Tzemach Atlas. And that you really see clearly the different hashkafot, the different ideologies. And well, let me actually let me just summarize it for you. I don't in the story, and it's semi-autobiographical, so it's always hard to know which event is actual autobiographical and which is not. I know I heard from Alan Nadler, who knew Chaim Grada, in fact, he wrote a memoir of him when Chaim Grada came to Harvard. Those of you who know Yiddish, there's a video of him and there's an audio. We could listen to some. In fact, he has a whole audio dealing with Musarniks and Nevardikers. Professor Tursky brought him to Harvard for two lectures. Nadler told me that Grada complained that the Haredim would always come to speak to him, but they didn't want to talk to him about all of his other writings or about ideas of literature. They only wanted to talk about the Chazon Ish, what he knew about the Chazon Ish. That or also told me that Chaim Grotto was, very upset that Isaac Bashevis Singer, Shaul Lieberman said that Chaim Grotto should have got the Nobel Prize. Chaim Grotto's attitude was Isaac Bashevis Singer is simply writing, semi-pornographic works, and that's that. You get a Nobel Prize for that. And the Rav. Or Soloveitchik was also was. We have a letter from him to Chaim Grad. I mean, the Chaim Grad, his portrayals are considered, the best fictional portray in fiction, the best portrayals of these figures in that world. Okay, so in the story, Chaim Grad, he and his father are living. They're living at this person's house. This woman and her daughter, who, as I recall, is a widow. And Chaim gets involved with the girl. And there's descriptions in the book. This is the sort of thing that they'll censor in the Haredi version. But if you censor this, it's hard to know then how you have the whole dispute between the Nevardiker and the Chazon Ish. So he describes how him and the girl, as I recall, she was a young widow. But they're living in the same house and they start kissing. And that's the description. It doesn't go any further than that. But, and she comes out to him. It's sort of like Rav Yaakov Emden's cousin. He tells a story in his autobiography. That's my recollection. Yeah, she comes out to him. But they are participants in this. And every chance they get, they go together to kiss. And Chaim Grotto realizes he has to remove himself from the situation. And people start to know. And it becomes the talk of the town. So it's a big problem. And he leaves the house. And just to go live on the street. He can't stay in the house because as long as he's in the house there, then there's the Yetzer Hara. And it can lead to disaster. So now we pick up then in the yeshiva. In volume 1, page 384. So the Chazon Ish finds out about this, and the Chazon Ish, and we know Chaim Grotto was was living with the Chazon Ish. According to this, if that's the story, how it happens, it would make sense. The Chazon Ish summons him. He knows him already, but Chaim Grotto goes to the Chazon Ish, and he's living with him. And the Chazon Ish's idea is to try to get him to the straight and narrow by removing him from where he was. And now, in the story here, the Nevardiker, remember, Chaim Grotto is also from Nevard, studying Nevardic, he goes to the Chazon Ish because the Nevardiker is convinced that there will be no tshuva for Chaim Grotto if he's living with the Chazon Ish. He has to come to Nevardic, and Nevardic will give him real tshuva. So they have a whole huge machlokas here, the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish's argument is that Chaim's going to study Torah full time, and that'll keep him the straight and narrow. So what does the Nevardiker say? He says that it's not going to work because you're not working. All you're doing is learning, but you're not working on his personality. You're not working on uprooting his evil inclinations. For the Chazon Ish, we're going to learn, and that's enough. And the Nevardiker says, he says to him, I can promise you this is temporary. It will only last as long as he considers it a great honor to be your pupil. The only reason he says he's here and that he ran away from the girl is because he thinks it's an honor to be with you. But once he gets used to you, he'll no longer have your image before his eyes during a moment of temptation. His hot blood won't come down because his teacher is Rav Avraham Shaya Kosover. Even if he becomes a diligent Ben Torah, he says the Talmud and its commentaries won't protect him from the Yetzer Hara. The Chazon Ish was saying, he's going to sit here and he's going to learn with me and that's enough. And the Nevardiker says, that's not doing anything because the learning doesn't get to the, as we saw before, learning is just a mitzvah. Are you going to tell me that if you shake a lulav all day, it's going to help you with the Yetzer Hara? No, you need to work on Yiran. You need to work in the Nevardic way. So the Chazon Ish, now this is obviously the recreation, I believe, of a dispute. We're not supposed to take it word for word. And maybe there never was such a dispute. Maybe the Nevardiker actually never came to the Chazon Ish, and Chaim Grotto is just portraying what each one of them thought or what he heard later, why he made him, it was a mistake to go to the Chazon Ish, whatever. But in this story, the Chazon Ish replies, you're a Rosh Yeshiva? And you can't imagine that Torah study can save someone from the Yetzer Hara? That is not the Musar, but just real Torah study. He says, the Chazon Ish says, the Gemara says, if you have Yetzer Hara, drag it to the base medrash. He says that when you learn Gemara, you imagine you're in Babylonia, sitting with the Gedolim there. And then Tzemach Atlas, the Nevardiker, replies and says, he says that, no, it doesn't work because we are matter. We're not like super tzaddikim. We're matter. Our body drags us down. Even the noblest Ben Torah. He says that a Torah scholar can be an evil genius. He can use pilpul to be mater every iser. When your lusts assail you, there's only one thing to do. Study Musar. So in other words, Chaim should come with me because we know how to deal with this. And he says the Chazon Ish laughs at this. He says that you know, someone can also make believe they're a Nevardiker and do all sorts of sins. And then Chazon Ish says, he says, you know, we're talking about people in yeshivas. Everyone in yeshiva is going to go out and have to make a living and earn a livelihood. And do you think the Musar he learned in Nevardik, you know, 10 years, 20 years down the road when he's a bala bus and he's supporting a family, you think that is going to save him from any yetzer hara that arises? He's in a provincial town where no other people, you know, just hamonam, the masses. He's not surrounded by yeshiva students. Is he going to be saved from sin by remembering your sermons of 20 years before? Chazon Ish thinks not. No, you need to have a Talmud Chacham, one who knows that he can go to the local base medrash and open up the Shulchan Aruch and learn Gemara. And that's, you know, that's good, what's going to keep him on the straight and narrow. In fact, he says he won't even need to run to the base medrash to open the Shulchan Aruch, because the Torah that he learned, you know, and he became a Talmud Chacham, that's going to last him a long time, while the Musar Shmuzes are going to extinguish. Because that's like a flame that goes up high and then is forgotten later. But if you give someone a strong background in Torah study, that'll remain his whole life. And it goes on, and that's the dispute. And the Chazon Ish wins it. At least Chaim doesn't leave him. He remains with him. So that's really, I think, the upshot of the great dispute. One other point I'll mention. The best article, I believe, in English, in the Chazon Ish, maybe in Hebrew also, is by Lawrence Kaplan. The title of the article is "The Chazon Ish, Haredi Critic of Traditional Orthodoxy." He discusses all the big points in the Chazon Ish's Weltanschauung, his opposition to the Brisker method, his criticism of Musar, his leadership in the Haredi world, and Kaplan makes a connection between his opposition to, you know, the new analytic approach of Torah study, and also the Musarniks, and there's some interesting points. But this is just one thing I'll mention for you. He says for the Chazon Ish, it's precisely the difficulty in observing mitzvot. That is, there's constant trials and struggles. And it's because of this ongoing struggle, by this, you develop the positive character traits that allow you to live a proper life. However, if you go to Nevardik, which is the one he criticizes most, it's not like that at all. In Nevardik, you had to do actions, what they call pu'us. That is, you have to do various actions, which then allow you to reach that point where you're living the proper way. But for the Chazon Ish, to observe halacha properly is consistently confronted with trials and tribulations. And that itself is all you need to focus on to be a Shulchan Aruch Yid, a Shulchan Aruch Jew, to be medetik in all the mitzvos. And if you do that properly, that creates who you should be. You don't need to do all these pa'ulos and all these, you know, extra spiritual exercises, which then gets you to the place that now you can learn. No, you don't need to. He says, this is what the Chazon Ish says in Emunah Bitachon, translated by Kaplan. And it's obvious that he has Navardic in mind. The precise fulfillment of the law is the only way to rectify evil traits. A person should not seek out trials in order to train himself in the rectification of his character traits. On the contrary, he says, you're supposed to avoid this. That is, you're not supposed to come up with certain plans to how to fix yourself. No, you're not supposed to think about these things. That's another problem, the Musarniks. They're always thinking about these matters. Don't think about them. Just do. A person who observes the commandments in all their precise details is able to train himself well to incite the good Yetzer and against the evil Yetzer. Okay, a couple more points about the Chazon Ish are worth noting because let me just quickly go through Brown. So I don't have time, I'll skip to it. The most interesting one for me is okay, let me just skip through some of them. I mean, it's a very detailed discussion here. Ah, okay, yeah. This is interesting, and this is also against Navardic. In Navardic, they thought that the important thing in Navardic was to have emuna in Hashem, that everything would work out, and you don't need hishtados. That is, you don't need to make any real efforts. I don't know what that means when I say you don't need hishtados, because everything you do is a form of, effort. But so, for instance, you're yeshiva bacher, you show up in a town, and you assume that there'll be a place to stay, that people will provide you with food, that you don't need to make a plan. Just do the right thing, and God will take care of you. And that's, for the Navardikers, that's what emunah is. To believe that in the end, if you just do what you're supposed to do, it will be taken care of. For the Chazon Ish, that's not emunah at all. That's not bitachon. For the Navardikers, bitachon is to believe that everything will work out. And if it doesn't work out, that's proof you didn't have the bitachon. And that's the proof that you don't have bitachon. So what is real bitachon? To believe that everything will work out. That's not the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish is just the opposite. What is bitachon? Bitachon is that everything that happens is from God. But there's no absolute answer that this is what's going to be. You could be a tzaddik and have all the bitachon, but yet it won't work out. And there'll be no, you'll have to go to work. There's no one going to be feeding you or anything. In other words, the Navardiker assumes that if you have the proper emunah, you will be taken care of. For the Chazon Ish, that's not emunah. That's not bitachon. Bitachon is to believe that everything's going to happen. It could happen, then it won't work out. That's hashgacha pratis. That you're not going to be able to be taken care of, and you have to end up leaving this small shtetl and go somewhere else where you find someone who's going to support you. So a completely opposite understanding of what does it mean to be a mamin, a believer, and have bitachon. And what does the Chazon Ish say? What is bitachon? It's the emunah she'en mikra ba'olam. That there's nothing by accident. But not that, God's going to take care of you. It's just belief in Hashgacha. So that's one interesting point, another criticism. Okay, let me go to the next. I'll skip a couple of things and go to what I consider the real interesting one, because this is this becomes a major dispute between the Chazon Ish and all the Musar teachers, it seems, not just Navardic. In fact, the Chazon Ish's elaboration is in direct opposition to a Musar shmuz we have of the Altar of Sobotka. So we know he's referring to Sobotkite Musar. In Musar, they speak about the idea of Negios. Negios, that is, all of us have, I don't know how to translate this, considerations or preconceptions and self-interest. That's the best term, I think, negios, self-interest. And part of what it means to be a Musar personality, bias, thank you, Rabbi Kelman, is to overcome this. Now, we can all appreciate this, but the Musar teachers, the Alter is explicit on this, I'll read it to you, state that everyone, even the Gedolim, have negios. Even the greatest of our sages have to struggle with this because they all have negios. In fact, one of the big negios that the Musar teachers were concerned with is favoring your children. And in fact, they say that the great dispute the Chazon Ish is going to have with them had to do with if you recall, Rav Yitzchak Ochanan, who did he want to succeed him? And he placed in the will his son, Rav Tzvi Rabinowitz becomes Rav of Kovno. If you recall, Rav Tzvi Rabinowitz was one of the leading anti-Mussar figures. So from the Mussar perspective, Rav Yitzchak Ochanan's specter, because of his negiah, loving his son, he didn't see that his son was not the best candidate and pushed his son forward, and the community picked his son to be Rav of Kovno, even though his son was a persecutor of the Mussar people. So for the Mussar teachers, everyone has negios, and I mean, some of us have negios, let's say, for money or for we want our pride, we want to have kavod, all this sort of thing. You know, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg says that he no longer considers himself a Mussar personality, even though his youth he was one. So it doesn't explain. What does that mean? He doesn't consider himself. It means he didn't study Mussar. It could mean that, but it also could mean Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg was honest. He said once, I love this because I think it's so realistic. And I guess if I love it, maybe I'm not a Mussarite. Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg said about himself, he says, I try not to chase after kavod, but if they give it to me, I will take it. I mean, you can't imagine a Mussarite say that yes, I too like kavod, and I'll take it if they give it to me, but I'll try not to chase after it. But Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg said he was honest. I mean, who doesn't like some kavod? But let's try not to chase after it. Don't be a boreach acharei kavod, or the kavod will run away from you. So the Mussar teachers speak about these negios, that everyone has negios. They bring proofs from the Gemara that everyone has negios. Wait till you hear the Chazon Ish's response to this. I don't know if we'll get to it today. No one can understand what the Chazon Ish is talking about. But they say he's the Chazon Ish. He knew what we all know, so there must be something. But I mean, this is so obvious, we would think, that everyone has negios, even the greatest Torah scholars, and you have to work on it, whether it's favoring a child who is not really the best one for the rabbinic job, or whether it's kavod. We know plenty of big rabbis have wanted kavod and things like that. So everyone has negios, only, maybe even Moshe Rabbeinu, I don't know, but only the Malachi Asharis, they don't have it. And that's a basic thing in Mussar. In fact, Rav Yisrael Salanter himself mentions this, but certainly the students of him mention this very strongly. Now, the Chazon Ish develops the idea that there are no negios for real great Torah scholars. I mean, he says two things. First of all, he says that he says this idea of saying that Gedolim could be influenced from negios is a distortion of proper Torah hashkafa. And the Mussar teachers, who say that in matters of, because they say also that their idea is that, in every area, even in halacha, let's say, there could be a time when a Mussar teacher is, when a rabbi is influenced by his hashkafa in an improper way. Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg writes that about one rabbi that, his friendliness to the irreligious led him to make a mistake. They said it about Rav Kook. His friendliness to the Chilonim led him to distort halacha. So that would be negios. The Chazon Ish says that this idea is impossible. First of all, he says there is no such a negia that can cause a halachic scholar to distort the halacha. Now, fact is that throughout history, in so many machlokas we have one gadol saying to another gadol that you've distorted the halacha precisely because of your negiah. That's a common thing in machlokas between gadolim when they argue. So when it gets personal, they always throw in the negios. So I'm not sure what the Chazon Ish would say about this. Is he's not going to say that one of them is not an authentic gadol, because I mean, you find this with gadolim Yisrael. We've spoken in the past between Rav Levi ben Habib and the Yaakov Beirav about reinstitution of smicha. But you have lots of examples. The Rambam's dispute with the Gaon of Bavel, and the Rishonim who dispute with each other. I mean, you find it all the time. That's the first thing he says. He takes this as a dogma And wait till you see the pasuk. Wait till you see what he tries to show. His conception of Jewish law from the Torah. He sees it to show this, that there's no such concept of negia when it comes to a Torah scholar in itself. But then he says it's also incorrect because according to this idea, l'fi hanacha zos, he says that this would lead to destruction of the Jewish community and nitzbatza Sanhedrin Yisrael Eretz. I mean, there wouldn't be any rabbinic leadership. So he's saying that this would be totally destructive of any rabbinic leadership because everyone will be able to look at a posek and say, well, you know, I can't trust his psak because he's probably doing it from, he has negio. So although he says that this is ab initio, it's wrong. The whole concept of negios doesn't apply to a real posek. He says it also has practical societal implications. As he says, that everyone will be able to say, litrosis horosoba is a negia. And you can always criticize them. And look, we do this, right? Don't the opponents of Rav Kook say that everything he does is because of Zionism? And the opponents of the Satmar Rebbe will say that, oh, is it any accident that every one of his psakim comes out like with an anti-Zionist, anti-State of Israel psak? Is it at all imaginable that Chazoni, that the Satmar Rebbe would ever come up with a psak that you know, has a positive implication for Zionism? So you would say that's his negius. And he says, because of this false idea, what we have is a generation that judges its leaders. Dor sheshofet eshoftav. Now, what I need to do next time is return, where does the Chazon Ish get this? And what we'll see amazingly is that he says it's a hoax. I mean, what about all the Gemaras, though, that say you can't judge your, you can't be in a bastion if it's a family member, things like that. Doesn't that apply in the Gia? But the Chazon Ish, and I'll get back to this again next class, which is to whet your appetite. The Chazon Ish says amazingly, do you know that if I'm a posek, I can poskin for myself? I have a chicken. My wife shechs the chicken. I can look at it and determine and poskin it kosher, even though I will lose money if it's treif. Why don't we say that I can't paskin for myself? I have to bring it to another rav because I might be led from my negios to save myself money and be, So the Chazon Ish is going to find his own proofs to say that when it comes to rabbanim, that we're not concerned with negios. And we'll get to, so what about the other cases I mentioned where the Altar Sabaka sites, you know, and being a based in, you know, family members. I'll get to that next week, how the Chazon Ish explains it. But it's an amazing thing. Think about this. If I'm a posek, and it doesn't just have to be a chicken. I can poskin anything about myself. I can poskin that the Erev is kosher. And you could say, well, it's because I want to be able to make my life easier. And I can poskin and I can do this and that. All the things that we look in the Sfarim and wonder, you know, is it going to make our life easier? Is it Lakua? If I'm the posek, I can poskin for myself. That should be forbidden. Because there's a conflict of interest. And Chazon Ish says no. Because we start with the principle that there are no negios with postgame. And according to the Alter's way of looking at it, it makes no sense because a postgame shouldn't be able to poskin for himself. He would always, you know, the Pope can't do confession for himself. Every Catholic priest has to go to confession to another person. I learned this at my university. Yeah, even the Pope goes to confession. But our Gedolim, no, they can decide it themselves. So the Chazon Ish is going to derive amazing things, controversial. I think he's a minority opinion, Das Yochi. But wait till you see some of the implications of this. So we will meet next week. I'll get to the questions now. And we will finish it up because I want to finish up. There's basically two more issues. This issue of Negios and then the Chazon Ish's dispute with the Musar Mu'un. With not, I won't say the Musar Mu'un as a whole, but certain Musar teachers. How do you judge when you look in now, Tanakh and you see all the sins they did? How are you supposed to judge them? Now, do we take it literally? Now, you are probably thinking the Chazon Ish is going to say, take it literally. Don't take it literally. Say it's an exaggeration. No, wait, the Chazon Ish is going to be the one to say, on the contrary. You know, for when it comes to the sins, the Avodah Zarah and all that, we have to assume they really did that. And wait to see what the Musar teachers have to say about that. And that's a big machlokas. And we will sum it up next week, God willing. So let me see. Someone says audio lost. Daniel, if the audio lost, it's on your end. Shmuel asks, aside from the Sipur, are there any other well-known Gedolim to come out of the Navardic system? I don't know of any offhand. Top level Gedolim like the Stipler. Shaul Lieberman studied for a little while in the Vardic. It's recorded, but I wouldn't say that he was really influenced by them. So I don't know. I it could be I'm just missing some, but nothing comes to mind offhand. But Mike says that there's a list. So let me, just while I have you here, because we have a lot of people who listen to us, who won't. So let me just. I went to the yeshiva. So here on the Wikipedia page, it says Rabbi Yecheskel Avramsky studied in Nevardic, but it's not. Yes, he did. Okay, he did study for a short time. He did. That's true. And Rav Zilber, okay, Rav Binyamin Zilber, the Oz Nidburu, he's a big posek as well as a Muslim personality. I should have remembered him. One person is mentioned, and I wouldn't call him a gadol, but certainly an important person in my world. I mean, a big time chacham is Rabbi Bochco, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Montreux Yeshiva, because Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg was in Montreux, and there was a yeshiva in Montreux, Switzerland, first yeshiva in Switzerland from like the late 20s, I think 28, 29. I believe it was already in the 20s. The yeshiva sort of existed there all those years until in the 1980s. The yeshiva went on Aliyah, and today the yeshiva is called Hechal Eliyahu. It's in a place in Israel called Kochav Miyakov. I think that's the name of the settlement, and it's a Hezri yeshiva, mostly for French people. So with that, we come to the end. I don't know which episode this is, maybe 22, and we'll be back for one more episode. The next series is going to be Rav Shmuel Molliver, the founder of Mizrahi, religious Zionism in a political sense. He's really the founder of it, I believe, the leading Gadol, I should say, who's involved with this. People ask me what's coming after that. Well, then we're going to do the Langer dispute. Those who asked me to do that, we did the dispute on Musser, to do the dispute of Hasidus. And I mean, that would be a tough thing. And maybe we'll do it. But I'm looking at Moshe Feierstein there. He's, I think, more suitable to do it than myself. Everyone should go to the Sfarim Chatter podcast to hear his discussion of his translation of Rav Chaim Vital's mystical autobiography, which recently came out. And but maybe we'll do the Machlokes. If I do that, the Machlokes, the Hasidim, non-Hasidim, I'm not just interested in the first generation. I'm interested as it continues up even till today, Machlokes Ashkenazim and Sfaradim. So I don't know, but I want to do Rav Shimon Shkop. After the Langer dispute, which is based on a request, I'm going to do Rav Shimon Shkop because there's a lot of really interesting things about Rav Shimon. So we'll do that. And look, as Roy Tarfon says, the day is short. We'll keep going until we can't, but we're not going to finish it. Just quickly before we end off, Gershon says, Rav Moshe Feinstein only drank Chol V'Yisrael. Was that to avoid Negius? No. I mean, what does Negius have to do with it? You say, no, it was because the previous avoidance of Chol V'Yisrael was like a neder. Yeah, I mean, in his children, in his house, there was not Chol V'Yisrael. His children did not drink Chol V'Yisrael. David Ruve, but he drank Chol V'Yisrael because he thought it was like a neder. You are correct in that. But again, it would. Negios would be just the opposite. Negios would be if he's living in a place like your Chabad people, they're very makpid on, they're mosar nefesh on Chol V'Yisrael. You go to a place like I was in India, and there's no Chol V'Yisrael there. The Chabad guy goes to the farmer and milks the cow himself. I mean, so if you're living in a place like that, and you come out with a psak saying you don't need Chol V'Yisrael, you could say, well, that's because of Negios, because it makes his life a lot easier. Rav Moshe, by not drinking Chol V'Yisrael, only drinking Chol V'Yisrael did not make his life easier. He made it harder, I guess, but that's it. And
he insisted that the reason was because previous avoidance constituted a neder.
Yeah, that's what they say. But he could be mevatel in the neder if he wanted. That's not a problem, being mevatel the neder. He thought it was a nice chumrah for him. That, it's not for the average person. It's not for everyone. But, everyone's supposed to take on chumrahs here and there, be a little more kadosh. So that he always did that in Russia, of course, when he first came to America. So then he concluded that you don't need to. So for himself, There's no need for him to change because there's Chol Yisrael. If he was living in Bangor, Maine, let's say, and Bangor, Maine used to be a place of Torah scholars, but Tzal Naor, the great Tzal Naor, comes from Bangor, Maine, or Omaha, or any of these places, if they didn't have Chol Yisrael milk, who says Rav Moshe would have held to this? He's not a Chabadnik. He's not a Chabad guy. He doesn't need to. He probably then would have drank, but he's living in New York where there's Chol Yisrael. So he was not Chol Yisrael. So now Jack says the Satmar Rebbe Trump promoted voting for Trump because Harris may pose danger for the Jews of Israel. Yes, that's Rav Aaron, the Kiryas Yoel. It's, basically they will support Hochul. The local, they always support the one they think is going to win because of the goodies they get. So in New York, it's a blue state, so they're definitely going to support the Democrats, and they always have. And this is interesting that they went for Trump. Maybe it's because he got word that his brother, who he's enemies with, is going to come out in favor of Harris. So he always has to do everything the opposite of his brother. So that could be it. But I'm not really sure exactly why he's Harris pose danger to the Jews. He said danger to the Jews. He didn't say danger to the Jews of Israel. That's not the report I saw. If you saw danger to the Jews of Israel, that's interesting.
He did. Exactly. Yeah. That's why I'm putting it as a comment.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's interesting. I don't know who's considered more moderate, but you have to see. I have to see actually if that's if when he said that he meant, and if he, yeah, that would be very interesting if he means in Medina Yisrael. And finally, last one, Mike says that Rav Moshe and Niras Moshe, the B'nai Torah should be machmir b'chol Yisrael. But the question is, what does it mean B'nai Torah? We know that yeshivas didn't, and we know that plenty of people who were B'nai Torah. So what he's saying is that you should, if it's not too complicated. But in his own house, we know they didn't. So again, there's a difference between Chol Yisrael and Chol Yisrael. I mean, it's one thing to get, in those days, you get Chol Yisrael milk. But does that mean you can't eat ice cream then? Regular ice cream, you can't have a Hershey's bar? All I can say is I know that in his family, they didn't hold of the idea of Chol Yisrael, at least to the extent that they wouldn't eat chocolate bars and things like that. Absolutely, they didn't hold to that. And I can tell you the Scranton Yeshiva, which is a Lakewood-type yeshiva, comes out of Lakewood, until like the 1980s, they didn't have any Chol Yisrael. They had chocolate bars and regular milk. And in the early years, Lakewood itself, we have Edut Ne'emana, I'm not making this up. The Lakewood Yeshiva itself, they didn't have Chol Yisrael in the very early years. So, Mark says he's seen the two Satmars in the same Kokore. Okay, they can be, we'll see what they say. But in general, they don't get along. And okay, thank you all. Rabbi Kelman.
Okay, thank you. Okay. By the way, I can tell you later if my Chaim Grada, if I remember correctly, is buried next to my uncle because he died penniless, right? Chaim Grada died penniless, I believe.
I think so. Yeah.
And I think my uncle arranged for the funeral and he gave him a plot next to where they are. And there, I know they're, but when my uncle passed away, I remember seeing the plot, and that's my cousins, if I remember, told me that story. But he arranged
By the way, about Chaim Grada, there's this Chabad guy named Zirkind. He wrote a master's in English at Tel Aviv University. I can send anyone who's interested on Chaim Grada. And he reads Yiddish, so he's able to – it's a nice little master's. You know, it's not a doctorate, but it's a very helpful little work on maybe 100 pages on Chaim Grada, and he has a chapter about the Chazon Ish. So, yeah.
Okay, we'll see you, please God, next week. Okay, I'm glad you're not giving the class on Tuesday night. All right. So, anyways, Rabbi.
No. Tuesday night. The question is Tuesday night, though. Are you looking at CNN, Fox News, MSNBC? You tell a lot about people by where they're tuned into on their computers.
I'm watching CBC, okay? Or CTV, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. I don't know what I'm watching. I don't know how to turn on RTV. I have to get, it takes me 10 minutes to figure it out. But anyways, but I thought Rabbi Shulman is starting his series next week on Sefer Yehoshua. It just went up on the website. So I told him he'd start Tuesday, but he's not allowed to talk any politics. It's at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It's going to be at the rate, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Listen, I voted today. An hour and 20 minutes online, early voting in West Orange, New Jersey. And they told me from 8 a.m. and it's going to go to 8 p.m. I was there like 5 o'clock. It's been an hour and a half, hour and 20 minutes the whole day. People are lining up. They're motivated. I don't know who they're motivated for, but they're motivated.
So you mean they're expecting a high turnout?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. We'll see what happens. Anyways. Okay. And by the way, Rabbi Shulman, coincidentally, or not, he's giving the parshas here this Thursday night on Noah. And okay, we look forward to learning with you. And share good news, and everybody should be well. And live the top, everybody. Thank you very much.
Toda rabah.
Toda rabah. Lala tov.
Erev tov. Laila tov.